The assumption in the Gospel of Mark is such a strange assumption. The assumption in the Gospel of Mark is that history does not have within it its own meaning. And the assumption is that history is coming to an end. That's the assumption. You know what the assumption is in the modern world? The assumption is that history is going on indefinitely, and that history has its own purposes and its own meaning. Now, if you want to see the contrast between those two assumptions, go back to the opening verses of the 13th chapter. And he came out of the temple. One of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." You see? And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Now you have the clash of those two assumptions in those opening verses. But when you see, well, no, I want to say something more. "But he who endures to the end will be saved." That is a tricky and slippery place, because that seems to go back and reestablish our power. And that is not what enduring to the end means. Enduring to the end is not a human achievement. And get that out of your heads. See, if you think that enduring to the end is a human achievement, you're already done in. Because the test and the trial will be so much greater than anything that you could conceive. And the test will come at the point where you are least prepared to meet it, and you're going to be wiped out. And if you want to see that played out fully, well, you don't want to see that played out fully. But whether you want to see it played out fully or not, Mark is going to play it out fully for you, and Simon Peter is going to be the major actor. "But he who endures to the end will be saved" does not reestablish human potentiality and human capability. Enduring to the end. Is not courage. It is not bravery. It is not strength.
That does not negate our responsibility to try.
It does not negate the opening verse, "Take heed to yourself." Now, "But when you see the desolating sacrilege set up where it ought not to be," let the reader understand. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down, nor enter his house to take anything away. And let him who is in the field not turn back to take his mantle." Now, again, this is talking about the persecution of the church. And it appeals to the episode under the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes IV and the desecration of the temple during the Maccabean revolt. That's the imagery. Now, what it refers to in the Markan situation, I don't know, but it refers to some kind of violation of the sacred. You know, it refers to the violence that accompanies that, and it makes it clear that when the faithful witness brings down the full fury of the foe, there is nothing that you can rely upon that you have. That it is, but this whole business about fleeing and taking off, you know, is very powerful language to help us to understand that in the hour of testing, everything fails. See? Judea, flee. And alas, for those who are with child and for those who give suck in those days. It is a terrible trial. Pray that it may not happen in winter. For in those days, there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation which God created until now and never will be. And again, I think what the text is suggesting is that the presence of the gospel community, the presence of the gospel, aggravates, accentuates, heightens the opposition to God in the world. And if the Lord had not shortened the days, no human being would be saved, but for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. Now, again, the text reminds us that no one perseveres on the basis of his or her own strength, that it is the action of God. And that marvelous biblical word, which has been torn out of its context for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. Then if anyone says to you, now this is speaking directly to the historical situation, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ. Or look, there he is. Do not believe it. False Christs and false prophets will arise and show signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. Now, this is a very, very important text in the Gospel of Mark. It brings to the fore what has been implicit all the way through, and that is that miracles are not proof of the witness. In fact, you may know that if one comes forward performing miracles and signs and saying this proves the credibility of the message, it is a false Christ and a false prophet. And one of the things that Jesus has done consistently is to be a true Christ. But take heed, I have told you all things beforehand. In other words, live out of the gospel. I have told you all things beforehand refers to the preaching and teaching of Jesus. Take heed, I have told you all things beforehand. It refers specifically to the teaching about the suffering, rejection, death, and resurrection of the Son of Man. You remember the last word that is spoken from the cloud on the Mount of Transfiguration. This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. Yes, Mark.
What significance is there in this, if possible, in verse 22?
Well, it just simply indicates that the elect are subject to the temptations, the testing, and trial. Election doesn't get one out of the trouble. It just puts one in it more deeply.
Excuse me,
who I beg your pardon?
Who are the elects?
Give me a sign. I don't know. The elect are hidden in the world. Nobody's asked me that for some time now. But when they do, my response is, don't be impertinent. Oh, the great, great biblical word that escapes all of our efforts to limit and define. It's a word that helps us to understand the ground of our assurance. And it is the divine action, you see. Nobody gets through the tribulation because of his or her courage or bravery or wisdom or piety or anything else. It is a needle's eye. And you know, all I'm trying to do this morning in going through this material is to help you realize that what has been said before in the Gospel of Mark is being hammered home in this strange language. It belongs to the story. It is an essential part of the story. It is not a disruption or an interruption in the story. But in those days, after that tribulation, now the whole scene is being shifted. This is a very important transition in this chapter. But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Now that is a cosmic picture. It is a picture of the end of history. This does not describe anything that will ever happen in history. It is the close of history. It is a different kind of imagery from wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes and being delivered up and standing before councils, you see. It rings down the curtain. It is over. It's the end that the Son of Man brings. And it is of a different quality and category. And that's the reason that you can never point anything within history and say, this is it. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Now, listen. You don't look at the fig tree and see that its branch has become tender and puts forth its leaves. You don't look at that and say, this is summer. See? You say summer is near. That's a different thing. You understand that? So also, when you see these things taking place, now what is these things? Wars, rumors of wars, being delivered up, all of that. When you see these things taking place, you know that he is near. That is, he's not here, but he is near. At the very gates. Truly I say to you, and this is that old mark and compression of history, this generation will not pass away before all these things take place. Now, all these things does not refer, really, to the cosmic development. It refers to these things that take place within history. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And that may be the crucial and critical text in the whole chapter. What is it that endures? It is the authoritative word of Jesus. And you want to know why Mark consistently presents Jesus as the teacher, preacher? This is it. You see, this is the way that transcendence is experienced in this transitory and ephemeral world. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And then, reverting the uncertainty of any kind of effort to put this on a calendar. But of that day or that hour, no one knows. Now, this is talking about the end of history, the consummation of God's purpose. This is talking about the parousia. See, the coming of the Son of Man in glory. But of that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Now that is an absolute statement about the impossibility of charting the end. No one knows. Now that is so clear that you know, there are a lot of things I don't understand about the 13th chapter of Mark, but that is very clear, isn't it? Anybody in this room can understand that, can't you? Huh? Well then, don't be led astray, and don't allow anybody to lead the church astray. Speak out clearly on this subject. Take heed. Watch. Now here is the word to the church in the period between resurrection, and parousia. No matter how short or how long that period is, you know, take heed, watch, for you do not know when the time will come. And the time there is a technical reference to the eschaton. It is a reference to the end. It is like a man going on a journey. When he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Watch, therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. The other gospel has its own integrity, and this one has its integrity, and it intends clearly to focus upon the Gethsemane episode. It moves you forward to that. And when you come to Gethsemane, Gethsemane will have all the more power because you've come through this. You see, you begin to see again how Mark has put this material together and ordered it. And notice here how the words, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And you, when you come to the Gethsemane narrative, you be alert to how sleeping is the motif that recurs throughout that narrative to describe the situation of the disciples. Watch, you see. And that's the other word. And that word is taken up again in the instruction of Jesus to the disciples. And he will get the inner circle together again. Yes, Emmanuel.
What strikes me is up here when Mark says that the angels, not the son, don't know.
That's right.
Did he say this intentionally, that Jesus doesn't know?
Exactly. 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 And that ought to be a great warning. If the master doesn't know, one thing ought to be quite clear. Disciples are not greater than the master. We can't stand that. There's no sense in being a disciple if you can't be greater than this master.
I was just going to say that in relation to that, in the 10th chapter, 40th verse, Jesus also said that it wasn't his place to determine who sits on the right hand or left hand.
In fact, you can pick up many things in the Gospel of Mark that emphasize the fact that Jesus doesn't know much. He's always asking people obvious questions. Yeah.
I sense there's more behind this word watch. Oh. Pointing towards the
sun. See, watching is another word for prayer. Watching is praying. Now, why don't you watch? Why wouldn't you pray? Watching is the acknowledgement that one has no power. What else is prayer? Well, if it is a confession, it is that again, you know, has to do with failure. It has to do with inadequacy. Watch is not a human possibility. You see, prayer is not a human possibility. Again, just get all of those words set within the context of the sovereignty of God. You cannot say, go to now, I will pray, try it, and your mind wanders off. How often? Or the prayer becomes another way. Well, you hear that happening. It's so difficult to pray because we pray in public. And our preoccupation is whether anybody will come around and say, that was a fine prayer. Oh, it's such a terrible word. Watch. Stay awake. And that's the one thing you can't do. Don't nod off. Stay awake. This is no time for sleep. You know, and the more you try to stay awake, the more you sleep. The two tremendous contrasts. Well, a tremendous contrast to Gospel Mark, and just call your attention to this without saying anything about it. But at the end of the fourth chapter, you remember, Jesus is asleep on the cushion in the stern of the boat. And the disciples are wide awake. You talk about an alert crew. And then you go to Gethsemane. And Jesus is awake all night long. And they sleep like babes. Think that over.
The reference then to pray always could be pretty well.
Yes. You can't do it. Pray without ceasing. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. What a See, that sets the whole passion within the drama of the deliverance of the people of God. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking out to arrest him by stealth and kill him. For they said, not during the feast, lest there be a tumult of the people. The recollection of the feast here, the remembrance of the feast, the celebration of the feast, instead of opening the eyes of the blind to the deliverance that God gives and God alone gives, it is the occasion for their anxious self-protection. We're going to do a terrible thing. But not during the feast, not because it is a contradiction of the feast, but because it might stir up the people and we might get hurt. See, the fact that one lives within the traditions of the deliverance of God does not mean that one lives out of dependence upon God. It may be that the traditions have become a way of avoiding the salvation of God. And that is the poignancy of setting the crucifixion within the celebration of the Passover. It ought to be a warning to everybody who has a great religious heritage. In fact, it seems that the Gospel of Mark is saying something that goes beyond that, and that is calling attention to the fact that the appearance of the gospel in the world accentuates the terror, aggravates it, reveals it, brings it out into the open, and therefore those who are identified with the gospel are subjected to greater suffering simply because of their relationship to the gospel. I think that that is the way the text is moving. So, everything that has been described up to this point as Jesus speaks to the disciples does not have to do with the cataclysm that is beyond history, that is the consummation of history, but rather it speaks directly to the disruptions, the upheavals that occur within history. And the caution is, do not mistake those historical developments with the end that is trans-historical. Yes. You can't say that because of the Russian Revolution, the end is upon us, you know. People are always doing that. Or to get it closer to home, you can't say that because of the current disaster in Washington, the end is upon us, you know.
The current disaster in Jerusalem.
Yeah, or the Falkland Islands or anywhere else, you know. You can say that, but that is to presume that those historical events really are somehow or other revelatory of the consummation of human history, which is always beyond history. It's the end of history. There won't be any historical report of the end of history. You understand that? If we could get that through our heads, we might get some things cleared up, but I doubt if we're going to get it through our heads. Yes?
Don't we sometimes read this and say, well, therefore, we can do nothing about Paul.
That is not what the text says.
Okay, I think that's
I said that before. I'll say it again. That is not what the text says. See. It is a realistic reading of the situation, but it doesn't say that one should accept the violence and the terror and say there's nothing I can do about it. Yes.
What does it mean that history will be consummated?
Well, it means that the purposes of God for creation will be carried out, and that those purposes, since it is God's purpose, the purpose of God always transcends anything that can happen within history, you know. So that you can never point to any particular historical development and say, aha, there is the consummation of the kingdom. That's idolatrous. Don't do it. That's like looking, that's what happens when people say, look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. It's not going to work. Yes?
How will we know when that happens?
You won't! That's exactly what the disciples are saying. Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign when these things are all to be accomplished? And there are no signs. And to be preoccupied with the signs is to miss the relevance of the consummation of history for history. And this chapter is going to focus very squarely upon what you do now. And how much more interesting it is to speculate about when and how will we know, huh? Well, I didn't mean to be so blunt, but I think the text is that blunt. It says, you know, anybody who comes and tells you this is a sign, the first thing that you ought to do is run as fast as you can in the other direction. For they're getting ready to use you. The text does not say that the kingdom of God will ever be realized fully within the limitations of time and space. You put it another way. The ownership of God, which is affirmed in chapters 11 and 12, is a hidden ownership. It is a sovereignty that is not demonstrated by any visible sign. That's the reason it's such a terrible matter, and why it always awaits a decision on our part.
Yes.
So that you begin to see the wars in the context of the sovereignty of God. There is no war that demonstrates that God is not sovereign. It is the other way around. It's the denial of God that reveals the power and the sovereignty of God. You have to read all of this in light of the cross, I suspect, in order for it to begin to have its full force. If you read it as something that justifies making war, it is wrong. It doesn't justify making war. The text never says for a moment that war is right. It just cautions you about any utopianism about your ability to get rid of war in a world that has fallen. You better take very seriously the doctrine of original sin when you set out to engage in any kind of social action. If you don't, you won't stay in the business of social action very long. Do you understand what I'm saying? Well, I think that does not say then that you're not responsible for what you do. And what what comes next really hangs out on us. It is the paradox of divine sovereignty and human responsibility. It is the logical inconsistency of the biblical witness that is there on every page. It is the must of the cross. It is no different from the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the scribes, the chief priests, and be killed. It is the divine must. It's rooted and grounded in the nature of God and in the fallen nature of the world. But it never relinquishes the insistence upon the responsibility of those who make war. Don't ever forget that. And it says something also about the tendency when you're under persecution to give in to the persecutors by resorting to the power of the persecutors. Now that is the terrible thing, you see. It not only has to do with physical violence, it has to do with the violence of the heart and the spirit. Terrible thing about violence is how dehumanizing it is, you know. But take heed to yourself. Notice the soberness of this. But take heed to yourselves. Huh? See, there is the focus of attention. Take heed to yourselves. For they will deliver you up to councils. See? And you will be beaten in synagogue. Now this is not symbolic language. This is speaking directly to a church that is in a situation of persecution. And as Marvin has pointed out, it is a church that knows powerlessness. It does not participate in ecclesiastical power. It does not participate in political power. And you will stand before governors and kings for my sake to bear testimony before them. Now you cannot, if you want to see what is in view here for the gospel writer, read the 14th and 15th chapters of the Gospel of Mark. And what I want to hammer down here so that it won't slip is that the interpretation of the 13th chapter is not speculation about the end. The interpretation is given in the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus in what unfolds in chapters 14 and 15. And again, to warn you against what happens in some of the commentaries, you know, the kind of flippant dismissal of chapter 13 as a disruption in the story. It is absolutely essential to the Markan development. And the themes that will be developed in 14 and 15 are implicit in 13. Yes.
Why can't this be symbolic too? Because my understanding would be if one followed Christ that this would follow century after century.
But that's not symbolic, that's real. That is not some spiritualizing of the text. It is talking about being delivered up, handed over. It is talking about the powerlessness of Jesus in the presence of the Sanhedrin. It is talking about the beating of Jesus. It is talking about the fact that Jesus stands before Pilate and gives his testimony. And what is the testimony? See, the testimony is to the absolute rule of God. and the denial of the rule of Pilate without ever participating in any of Pilate's power. Take heed to yourselves. You see, the temptation is, and this is, the temptation is in the hour of persecution to forget that the victory has been won. And to think that everything hinges upon our ability to amass greater physical power. See? That is the revolutionary heresy. And it is always lurking in the wings of the stage. It wants to come in and take center place and push the gospel person out of the central role and replace the gospel person with a Davidic king. Take heed to yourselves. And then, and the gospel must first be preached to all nations. And there, what the church is being confronted with is that the persecution, the martyrdom of the church is the witness of the church. See? The martyrdom, the words, the Greek word for martyr and the Greek word for witness have the same root. And when they bring you to trial and deliver you up, do not be anxious beforehand what you're to say, but say whatever is given you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Again, the text calls for that kind of absolute dependence upon God, which is revealed in the widow, which is revealed in Jesus. Do not. Now, this is not a text about sermon preparation, you know. Well, it may be. You know, when you stop to think about it, it may be that what ruins the sermon is what ruins every witness, and that is self-centeredness, anxious defensiveness. So it may be. Do not be anxious beforehand what you are to say, but say whatever is given you in the hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. See, the Spirit, why invoke the Spirit at this point? We haven't heard anything about the Spirit for pages, have we? It's interesting to me that everybody's concerned about Andrew popping up here, but here's the Spirit popping up. You know. And we hadn't heard anything about the Spirit for chapters. Why? Well, you know why. It is the Spirit in Jesus that is the power that overthrows evil. It is the Spirit that drives Jesus out into the desert, and it is in the power of the Spirit that Satan is overcome. See? Now, what is being said is that power is available to the church in the hour of persecution. Don't be anxious. It's not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. And the amazing thing is that there have been moments in the history of the world when that voice has spoken. When people that you had no right to expect would come forward and stand in the presence of all the massed violence of the world and speak the word of truth. And nothing could silence that word. I doubt if we would have had the Gospel of Mark if it hadn't been for that. We wouldn't be here if it were not for that. And brother will deliver up brother to death, and the father, his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death, for you will be hated by all for my name's sake. You see, here again, the dependence upon God that is characteristic of witnesses to the kingdom is a schismatic force in the life of the world. It splits the world apart. And this is what I meant when I said it aggravates the situation. All the natural alliances are brought into question by this supernatural reference. See, the transcendent reference, I guess, is a better way to put it. Supernatural scares us. We think that has to do with some kind of miracle or something. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end will be saved. Well, you see how the text has just shifted the focus of attention. Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign when these things are all to be accomplished? And the word of Jesus, take heed to yourselves. Oh, see, why? Take heed to yourself because we want to participate in the power. We want to wheel and deal. We want to be able to make things happen. You know? We want to be affirmed. Oh. We want to be loved, don't we? When they vote for the outstanding citizen, we always look at that list and wonder why in the world we didn't make it, you know. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. Now, the for my name's sake is absolutely essential. See, the name is the power of Jesus. For my name's sake. And the power of the gospel is the antithesis of the power of the world. And wherever the power of the gospel is manifest, it comes into conflict with the power of the world. It is the antagonist. See. Yes. Oh, I think it is speaking to the church. Take heed to yourselves. It is the fact that this community is ordered in a different way, and this community is an offense to the communities of the world. So beware when the church is no longer offensive to the communities of the world. I mean, when the communities of the world can invite the church to come and give invocations, you know something has gone wrong. The world expects the church to come and give an innocuous invocation. The church doesn't come and say, "Do you see these great buildings?" You know, when we're invited to make an invocation, we come and say, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And we become chaplains, you see. Yes, John?
I guess what the paradox is, I'm trying to carve out the community of faithful remnant.
Oh, yeah.
Loving community.
Yes.
At the same time, in doing that, I may be missing the force of the text to me.
What? Oh.
In the sense
that we're...
Well, I'm not going to be hated by all people. I'll still have this loving support of
the community
that will give me my love, my strokes, my security.
One has to run the risk of being alienated from the community. One has to run the risk of having the community enter into the betrayal. See, the poignancy of this is that nobody endures to the end except Jesus. And he in the end is hated by all. Jerry?
Excuse me. I'm kind of confused with this end business.
What?
This end business, the word here that says, "To the end will be sealed."
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. Mark has this whole business of the compression. I'm quite clear that the Markan church believed that no matter how uncertain the end was, that it was coming immediately. You know, no matter how difficult it is to chart that, they believed it was coming. Not in the far-off distant future. The history was coming to an end.
How would he was speaking to his... the people of his day.
His church.
How could we translate it to people of our day, kids?
Well, just say quite clearly, and I think say without any attempt to apologize, that it looks like that the Markan chronology was a little bit off. That doesn't matter. The thing that matters is the assurance that the church has because of the crucifixion and the resurrection, that God's purpose is invincible and God's purpose will be accomplished. The consummation is sure. Oh, I've said before, if I have to choose between people who have the wrong chronology about the end and people who have no notion of the end, I'll go with the people who have the wrong chronology every time. Just take it for granted that you're going to have the wrong chronology. That's not your business anyway. Jesus already said that. Yes, Mona.
When I read verses like that, I always interpret it to mean then that that's, the end is really the end of my own history. Is there something wrong with that kind of thing?
Well, there is, because I think that lets go of the corporate, the cosmic dimensions of the Christian hope. The Christian hope is more than your personal salvation. If you don't believe that, then you're going to do some very strange things in relationship to the world and your neighbor.
Well, then how can you think of the end in our...
Think of the end. I don't know how to think of the end. I don't have any... there are a lot of images about that in the Bible, but they are images and symbols. They should not be taken literally. To think of it in terms of the love of God and the assurance that what God has begun, God will bring to consummation. And to cling to that, well, that's all you have to cling to. And when you let that go, you have indeed let everything go. That's the reason that's so important. That's the reason this whole eschatological business is so important. It's in terms of God's purpose. It's in terms of God's goodness. It is an affirmation about the power and goodness of God. And it calls us to faith in the power and goodness of God, to believe that God's goodness is greater than the evil that is rampant in the world. It is scandalous to believe that. But to believe that is the crisis of faith. Mark has a kind of vision, though, that God is for all, and the witness of the church is to all the nations. You know, one of the reasons the temple is damned and doomed is that the temple, which was intended to be a house of prayer for all the nations, has been transformed into a den of robbers. You see? The gospel is for all the nations, and the martyrdom of the church makes that clear.
But that's an action.
Certainly, the cross is an action. But it is not aggressive. It is not violent. It is passive. It is passion. It is the negation of everything that we are so that God may be all in all.